Hello, everyone, and welcome to Risky Business number 155. I'm Patrick Gray. In this week's show, with apologies to our offshore listeners, we'll be taking a close look at a distinctly Australian topic, the CERT Wars. The fierce political battles here in Australia involving AUSCERT, the non-government organisation, and CERT Australia, the new government-controlled CERT, which is hosted in the Attorney-General's Department. The intended cooperation between AUSCERT and CERT Australia imploded spectacularly just over a week ago. The government is now vowing, in essence, to wipe out AUSCERT. It's very heavy stuff. We'll be joined by AUSCERT's general manager, Graham Ingram, to get his reaction to that, and we'll also hear from our secret squirrel mystery. This week's podcast is brought to you by Checkpoint Software, and in this week's sponsor interview, we'll be chatting with the company's engineering services manager, Aviv Abramovich, and we'll be having a chat about the leak of the US military's so-called collateral murder video. As it turns out, it was an insider who leaked the video. Specialist Bradley Manning simply burned the file onto a disc. But what can organisations do to deter, if not stop, insiders doing stuff like this? That interview is coming up later. Now, normally we'd be checking in with Adam Boileau to do the week's news, but he's off in Singapore eating chili crabs, having a good time, hanging out in the tropics at Syscan. So this week, we're pleased to have Azimuth Securities' Mark Dowd on the show to fill in for Adam. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me, Patrick.
We just got a few news stories this week to go over. It's been a relatively quiet week, but some good stories here. And look, this one is smack bang in, squarely in your field of expertise and interest. A bloke who works for Google has been criticised for disclosing a Windows-related bug. He dropped some exploit code for this XP flaw, despite having only notified Microsoft 5 days prior, and he's copped a lot of flack for that. Is that what happened?
So this goes back to the age-old disclosure debate, really. But in this particular case, that is what happened. He contacted Microsoft originally. He tried to negotiate a release with them, but apparently they were wanting to put it off for quite some months, and he thought it was more urgent that the community at large knew about it so they could do something to patch it, because he believed it was likely that it could be, trivially exploited on a fairly large scale.
So he engaged in a little bit of scorched earth diplomacy.
He did. You should note that he's done quite a few disclosures with Microsoft before, and in the past he felt he had to delay disclosure for periods of time that were longer than what he thought was adequate, and they were quite long, 7-8 months, something like that. And he thought in this particular case, he was talking to them and they were talking about a disclosure timeline of at least a couple of months, but I think it was up to 6, although I could be wrong about that.
Well, I bet you it's not going to take them 6 months to patch this now that the code's out in the wild.
Yeah, they have a emergency response that they sort of do where if something's found in the wild, they'll work overtime and push that to the front of the queue, basically, and try and get out a patch as soon as possible and maybe even do an out-of-cycle patch.
Yeah, it strikes me that though a lot of the media coverage has focused on the fact that this guy works for Google, and there seems to be this sort of implication that he was somehow encouraged by Google to give Microsoft a hard time. What do you make of that? Because it seems to be quite a flap.
Yeah, I don't think that's true. I mean, it certainly makes stories sound more juicy to put something like that in. But in reality, I've worked with quite a few of the Google guys in the past, and I was doing that work for Chrome recently, and basically a lot of the security team gets a certain component of time to do their own security research, which they're more or less free to publish as they wish whenever they do it, and they're not really encouraged in one way or the other. And you will have seen the fruits of a lot of this research in the past. Quite a few of their... The security team has given talks at a number of security conferences in the recent past. So they disclose a lot of vulnerabilities and stuff like that of their own accord quite regularly. It's just in this particular case, Tavis decided to forego the usual Microsoft disclosure process in favor of full disclosure. But I don't really think that the company encourages that kind of,
Yeah, you don't think it's like deliberate sort of strategy on Google's part to sort of make Microsoft look like asses?
No, I don't think so. They don't really operate in that kind of way, yeah. In my opinion.
Yeah. Well, it's funny too, because Mike Reavy, he's one of the Microsoft guys. He's the MSRC director, wrote up a big blog post just, sort of, he basically just did his block, as much as a Microsoft person can on a company blog. But interesting anyway, and lots of to and fro. Lots of people getting very annoyed at the guy, other people defending his right to publish. I guess it's just one of those things. It depends.
Yeah, the actual Google versus Microsoft whole discussion was probably fueled by the incident a few weeks earlier where Google had indicated that they were going to ditch Windows entirely internally.
Yeah.
In favor of other operating systems. So that was probably like a pretext for a lot of the controversy or a lot of the discussion that followed.
Mm. Well, I think it's funny, actually. We had Greg Shipley on the show a while ago talking about that, and we thought, it's not your operating system that's your problem when you're getting owned via a hole in a 9-year-old browser. It could just mean that your desktop management sucks balls.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, no software is perfect, right?
Moving on to this next story, and there's a program actually being spearheaded by Microsoft that looks pretty interesting. It's designed to provide a way for researchers who come across a stolen credit card numbers to actually report that data to some sort of central body that can then distribute that to merchants and banks and stuff like that. Because, often researchers from certs or whatever, they might stumble across some botnet logs or stuff like that that are full of credit card numbers. And there's been attempts at distributing that information to the, to the card companies and whatnot in the past, but they haven't been overly successful. And this looks like an attempt to address that. Have I got this right?
Yeah. I read a little bit about this earlier, and it's an interesting idea because I can see how that would have been a problem in the past with no formal infrastructure to report such things, and having the researcher have the responsibility of approaching the banks. And of course, a lot of the times the banks might not take them particularly seriously or not really know if it's legitimate or whatever. So having a big company or companies, sponsor some sort of initiative where it can be centrally reported seems like a really good idea to me, and maybe could even be extended beyond researchers to, the general public in the end.
Yeah, it strikes me as like a cert-style coordination effort for stolen data, not vulnerability information, which, it seems like a good idea.
Yeah, especially in the climate now where you have a lot of, zero-day vulnerabilities that are being used in malware and stuff like that, and the malware is causing all sorts of problems because they data mine credit cards and stuff like that. So it seems like a really good idea, particularly to reach out to researchers and AV vendors and stuff like that, that probably come across, botnets and things all the time that have harvested this kind of information and they've had no reporting policy.
Yeah, there's probably card data in there from about 10 different institutions, and can they be bothered finding the right point of contact for everyone?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I can imagine, though, actually, there's a few, we've got quite a lot of listeners in the finance sector and banking. I can imagine a few of them are hitting Google at the moment looking for that report. But that report was it's an AAP report carried on, I think it was carried on ZDNet. And its title is New Way to Report Stolen Credit Cards, if anyone's interested in chasing that one up.
We'd want to hope that the thing that they spearhead actually has quite good security as well.
Yeah, that'd be great to be sitting there, wouldn't it? It'd just be great to be sitting on the top of that program just sucking down a few hundred thousand credit card numbers a day. But how to be Gonzalez the easy way. Now, look, this has been an interesting story developing over the last couple of weeks or over the last week, and CNET has done a very good job of covering this. A bloke named Weave, a sort of, he's one of those guys who trolls on Full Disclosure. Him and his buddies formed a group called, and this is the most mature name for a researcher group, Goatsy Security. And they found a very basic flaw in the web application that AT&T was using to do something to do with the iPad anyway. And they basically realized that they could extract the email addresses of everyone who had sort of registered to get an iPad or had bought an iPad. Something like 100,000 email addresses and I think IMEI numbers or some sort of device number as well. Nothing that crazy. But, you know, he went public with this thing, causing... you know, a lot of people to fret, especially AT&T, which, you know, other reports have said they didn't even test their web application before putting it online, which is a definite no-no. But the story gets really interesting where when the FBI raid this Weave guy, whose real name is Andrew Ornheimer, they raided his house and they found drugs there and they locked him up.
Yeah, probably not a good idea if you're publicly exposing millions of users or hundreds of thousands of users in personal information to have a bunch of drugs at your house.
Yeah, man, I mean, it might be time to hide the crack pipe. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. It was a pretty interesting story. It made a lot of news and, you know, all the talk of the iPad since it came out so recently. And then, yeah, to have this massive security breach, which actually had nothing to do with Apple really and everything to do with AT&T, kind of stirred up a lot of interest in what could be done with that kind of information, not just the email addresses, but the device, the device numbers and stuff like that. So, yeah, it was a pretty big deal, I think. And I'm guessing AT&T are going to be a lot more careful in future about doing like penetration testing on their web applications and stuff like that. At very least, I guess now that they've received quite a public black eye about it, they'll be a lot more careful in future about allowing untested web applications with quite a lot of interesting information behind them to be deployed publicly.
Yeah, it just looked like one of those classic Clanger design flaws. You know, there's some detail on Gawker. They broke the story. It's called Apple's Worst Security Breach, 114,000 iPad owners exposed. They broke the story, but... you know, just looks like the sort of hack that your bloody 5-year-old nephew could do. It just seemed really basic. But yeah, you know, if you're going to jump up and down and make a big deal out of owning a telco, hide the crack pipe. This is also a guy who told Brian Krebs when he was still with the Washington Post. I think he was interviewed him at some conference, and he claimed he had been taking acid when he was doing his talk. And you know, he's been involved in some pretty epic troll wars on Full Disclosure. You know, his whole family was named and, you know, just really, really nasty stuff. So this guy's been around for a while and he's got a reputation as a bit of a tripper.
Yeah, I guess so. What we don't know is whether the drove him to trolling or trolling drove him to drugs.
You think it's one of the more interesting chicken versus egg?
Yeah.
All right, Mark. Well, thank you very much for filling in for Adam while he's off in Singapore, and I'm sure we'll have you back on the show soon.
All right, cool. It was good talking to you.
Azimuth Security's Mark Dowd on the line from Sydney there with a look at the week's big news stories. So thank you, Mark. It's time now to have a look at Australia's cert wars. It was in 2008 that the Australian government announced plans to create an Attorney General's Department hosted CERT that would subcontract services out to Australia's existing computer emergency response team, AusCERT. Unicorns would skip through meadows as the new government body seamlessly fused with AusCERT in an orgasmic bonding worthy of a Mills and Boone plot. But around 8 days ago, AusCERT and the government formally announced the total breakdown in negotiations. The courtship is well and truly over, and let me tell you, it's a bad breakup. If this was a real breakup, CERT Australia would have trashed AusCERT's CD collection and given all of its favourite clothes to Vinnies. AusCERT, in turn, would be off shagging CERT Australia's best friend in new, imaginative and uncharacteristically dirty ways, you know, just to rub it in. This is all a way of saying there will be no relationship between CERT Australia, the new body, and AusCERT. In fact, Australia's Attorney General himself has said that CERT Australia will be the sole point of contact for Australian organisations that need to contact AusCERT. In other words, they are proclaiming already that AusCERT is dead. But despite such statements, the government can't actually close a member-funded NGO. They don't have a magic wand like that. So, and, you know, short of a black ops raid on their Brisbane headquarters, I just don't think it's going to happen. So AusCert, for its part, is claiming that it's business as usual. And, you know, we'll be looking at whether or not that's realistic. But how did we get here? Well, for 17 years, AusCert has operated out of the University of Queensland. It employs something like 17 or 18 people, and it does all of the usual CERT stuff. Malicious site takedowns, coordinating vulnerability disclosures, and, you know, doing incident response stuff. AusCert also successfully tendered to run a government-funded IT security alerting and online information scheme. But the world is changing, and CERTs are being absorbed by governments worldwide. This is the trend. So the federal government decided to take the step and establish a new group inside the Attorney General's department. Then the goal was to actually use AusCert to actually subcontract out a lot of this government work to AusCert, and negotiations began. Now, from what everyone has told me, these negotiations were a mess from the beginning. You'll hear our next guest, Graham Ingram. You will hear him deny that, but that is what I have heard. The overwhelming impression I get is that neither party went into negotiations in particularly good faith, and there were strong personality clashes at the most senior levels that ensured the whole thing was more or less doomed from the beginning. I am told AusCert had proposed things like charging the government for data it provides for free to certs in other countries. I am told AusCert wanted to charge CERT Australia $1,500 a day for CERT Australia to access its staff. As for the government side, I'm told they were trying to extract too many services from AusCert at too low a price. They also apparently wanted to take way too much control over AusCert's operations and were deliberately inflexible so as to scuttle the negotiations. And let me tell you, things got decidedly sneaky towards the end. Even before the cessation of the negotiations between the two CERTs was announced, I was told by two separate sources, that the government had approached six AusCert staff members with job offers. Now, the government denied this in an email. I put that to them in an email. They denied it. But I can honestly say the Attorney General's Department has been quite unbelievably sneaky in its handling of media inquiries on this matter. On May 24, the department told me it had not approached six staff with job offers. On June 16, it tells me it has. On May 24, the department tells me it has no office in Brisbane. Now it tells me it's setting one up specifically to house staff poached from AusCert. Many of the answers to a series of questions I sent the department on the 24th of May were, I believe, deliberately misleading, and repeated requests for interviews to clarify the answers were denied. The department at one point even tried telling me that it's unorthodox for departmental officials to be provided for interview. Now, as someone who's been a newspaper journalist in this country for nearly 9 years, I can tell you that that is complete and utter bullshit. In fact, the government allowed CERT Australia's Mike Rothery to speak with friendly journalists last week after the cessation of negotiations were announced. But will anyone from CERT Australia appear on this program? No way. And I personally believe that's because they don't wish to expose department officials to embarrassing questions. But look, anyway, AusCert's Graham Ingram did decide to front Risky Business to put forward his side of the story, and here's what he had to say.
Well, for us, it's business as usual. We've got very much the same issues we deal with for our members and also the public, and we'll just be continuing with what we've, continuing and improving what we do as a non-government, not-for-profit CERT in this country.
Now, it seems pretty clear that CERT Australia will seek to take over some of the functions of AusCert. I even believe that they are hiring former and current AusCert staff away from the organisation. Rob Mead is one who's gone over to CERT Australia. Carl Hanmore is another one who's also gone. And I understand that job offers have gone out to about six of the AusCert staff. Is that making life difficult?
It'd be a joke if I said it wasn't making life difficult. Obviously, if we lose staff, and frankly, Carl had already left AusCert and he'd gone to Microsoft, as you know. So he was on extended leave, and he just so he changed his mind. Robert Mead had already left AusCert and was working with the Queensland government, so they weren't in many ways directly hired from AusCert. But certainly the Attorney General's Department have advised us that as a result of the placing of ads in the paper and opening an office in Brisbane, that they are intending to offer jobs to existing AusCert staff. And yes, that's not a great, it doesn't excite me very much, obviously, because these are key staff. It takes a lot of time to train and to get the level of experience to work in a cert. So having to do that, I mean, I would much prefer it if they'd chosen to do that themselves rather than than take our staff. But,
well, look, Graeme, it wasn't supposed to be this way, was it? Because in the early days, there was a budget announcement saying there would be extra funding for CERT services. Whoop-de-doo, everybody thought it was going to be fantastic. This new body would be formed under the Attorney General's Department. A lot of the work would be subcontracted out to AusCert. Why didn't that happen? What went wrong? Because my understanding is, and this isn't just one or two sources, everyone's told me that the negotiations were more or less a disaster from word dot.
Look, I don't think they were a disaster from word dot. I think the original plan, which was under the government's cybersecurity strategy, made sense. It was basically to coordinate and bring together the nation's existing CERT arrangements, which obviously included AusCert. We said to the government in the e-security review is that we really need dedicated and more funding. The government turned around and came out with their findings, which they said, look, we think the better way of doing this instead of funding AusCert is to create our own CERT. But then they said that this is, we'd like to bring it all together. And that sounded like a fairly reasonable approach. So the only disagreement, I suppose, at that early stage was having it as a CERT as part of a deeply entrenched within core government. I've seen a lot of models of CERTs around the world over time, and what I find is that the removal of the CERT slightly from government funded certainly, but slightly removed as a government business enterprise or some standalone agency was a better way of bridging the gap between government and industry. But again, that was not our decision.
How did we get here though, Graeme? Because it's got to the point now where basically CERT Australia is trying to hire away your key staff. They were trying to do this, or that was their plan, in addition to setting up an office in Brisbane before the cessation of negotiations with you.
Yep.
I mean, you must be quite furious about this because it seems that they haven't exactly been playing with a straight bat.
I'm disappointed. Of course I am. I would have much preferred that we'd gone through with the negotiations. But to some extent, that's irrelevant now. If there are staff losses, I'll just have to work with that. But we will continue. I think a lot of people have this belief or confusion that somehow CERT Australia begins and AusCert ends. That's not true. We have an existing business. We have a business model. We have a lot of support. We have a lot of, we have 17 years of experience in doing this. I've seen all sorts of reporting in the media, some of which is complete news to me. The fact that the negotiations stopped because of the price. Well, that's rubbish. The price was set. What we were trying to do was establish what services could be provided for the price.
And that price was, I believe that was what, $6 million over 4 years was part of the initial negotiation, wasn't it, between AusCert and the Attorney General's Department, the idea being that they would subcontract out services to you with that budget?
I don't want to go into the numbers, but that was reasonably close to what was initially discussed.
Okay.
We were always quite willing and happy and prepared to provide services to the Australian government, to CERT Australia. And what we were really interested in was a partnership where we could complement each other's roles. Because CERT Australia or GovCert.au at that stage did have a high focus on government. Our focus is industry, but we do have a lot of government contacts. And we just thought that a partnership was certainly a better way forward for Australia. Now, the fact that the government's policy said that, the fact that now we have two CERTs who are will continue on their own way. I have got no way of knowing what the CERT Australia will be doing. I'm hoping that it will be complementary to ours. It certainly makes no sense to duplicate. But, I think we'll just have to wait and see how it eventuates from now. Now the negotiations, the Attorney General's Department has broken off those negotiations. I'm not sure what the outcome will be.
Look, a lot of sources have told me that certainly very quickly after negotiations commenced, you yourself were not particularly keen on working with the government. Do you refute that?
Oh, totally, totally. I was not comfortable with the contract, with the services that the government were trying to procure, and the the arrangements around those, but that was quite specific.
We've also heard things, Graham, along the lines of, OSSERT wanting to charge CERT Australia and the Attorney General's Department for certain services or data or feeds or what have yous, where that service is provided to other CERTs for free internationally. Do you refute that as well?
Yes, I do, actually. Very much so.
So that's an absolute denial then, that there were services that you were seeking to charge AGs for that you were providing for free to other CERTs.
I won't say, look, when you say it's an absolute, there's nothing quite an absolute, okay? We have certain arrangements with other CERTs where we actually trade information. So I don't put a value, dollar value on it, because we're giving and they're giving and we're both, and there's a benefit in that. What CERT Australia wanted was a specific feed to meet their requirements. That is quite a different case. So I think given the subtleties of this business, I think talking in absolutes is a little bit of an absurd way of dealing with it.
Okay. We also hear that as part of the negotiations, OSSERT wanted to effectively bill out its analysts to the Attorney General's Department for a figure approaching $1,500 a day. Is that correct, Graham?
I won't go into the figures, but what I will say is that the Attorney General's Department want staff, and we, in terms of, they wanted the actual staff, not the services, and we came to something that would be, in our view, a reasonable amount, almost at a cost level for us.
So, and that number that I mentioned, I mean, you're not going to tell me if I'm close, if I'm anywhere near to the correct figure?
No, I won't. No, I won't tell you close to it. But look, you do your own figures. If you have a staff member that costs you, say, $100,000 a year in to pay on all the costs and on costs, you work out what that is in hourly rate. You do your own figures. But I'm saying is that I certainly was not in the business of giving staff that we have to pay salaries to CERT Australia for $0.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we may be not for profit, but we're certainly not for loss.
Well, actually, that's a question too. Is I believe, you know, there was a management change at the University of Queensland where you were based. And there is a strong emphasis on cost cutting and a strong emphasis on turning services like, you know, CERTs or whatever into profit-making enterprises. Was there any pressure like that internally from the university to have OSSERT sort of capitalise on the negotiations with CERT Australia?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. What the message coming from the university is very supportive of OSSERT, and it is. But it's basically saying that OSSERT can't be a black hole. It can't consume monies. It can't be a cost centre to the university. In other words, if OSSERT is a not-for-profit and can make revenues that roughly equate to costs, then we are a valued member of this university.
Okay. Now, look, the Federal Attorney General, Robert McClelland, is quoted in an Australian article as saying CERT Australia will now be the sole supplier of national CERT services to the community and the point of contact for international CERTs. This is effectively the federal government saying that OSSERT is dead to them. I mean, how do you react to that sort of comment, Graham?
The way I react is that the global community of CERTs and the businesses and members we have in Australia will make up their own minds. They certainly won't be dictated to as to who they can or will talk to. Basically, this is a community that's existed for a long, long time, certainly as long as I've been at OSSERT. And the two issues that really drive the community are trust and delivery. If you do the job and you do it well, then you will be the person who will... It's about performance.
So, Graham, why would someone come to OSSERT now when we've got the federal government saying CERT Australia is the CERT? It is the sole point of contact. It is the only body receiving government assistance. Why then would someone choose to go to OSSERT for services and pay money when they could be getting free services from this taxpayer-funded institute?
Look, I just don't know. There's possibly a number of reasons. Maybe someone doesn't necessarily want to tell the government what's happening. You know, if they have an incident, they may not feel comfortable with the telling the Attorney General's Department about it. They might wish to have it done quietly. In many cases, industries and private enterprise will do what it wants to do based on what the outcomes it's seeking.
Well, I mean, there's also the point that the Attorney General's Department, I mean, that is the department controlled by the chief lawmaker in the country. I mean, this is also the department that referred Google to the Australian Federal Police for prosecution over the Wi-Fi data collection thing. I mean, there could be some complications, couldn't there, in reporting certain types of incidents to AGs, you know, especially if we have things like data breach disclosure laws and whatnot.
I think you paint a very interesting environment, and certainly one of the things at OSCET is that we would maintain the confidentiality of the information we have with our members as being absolute. We will not pass it on to any other party without their permission. And that's one of the mantras of the CERT environment. You must have that. So, yes, maybe what you're suggesting has got some future implications that people need, particularly large businesses, need to be very, cognizant about.
All righty. So do you believe that the government will dump its subscriptions to OSCERT services? That's about $250,000 a year for you guys, reportedly.
Reportedly. Well, I can say it's not. That's an interesting figure, and I'm not sure where it came from myself. Look, I don't know. We have existing arrangements. Over the next 12 months, it'll probably become clearer what will happen. I don't have my crystal ball at the moment, Patrick. I do believe that there is a whole range of members out there who will say, yes, they're happy to take what they can get free from the government, but they're also happy to have OSCERT available to them if they want something dealt with. And they will now have a choice. And I will, wait and see what their choice is.
OSCERT's Graham Ingram on the line from Brisbane there with his side of this whole snafu. Now it's time to hear from the secret squirrel. Now this is an interview with someone who's actually been quite close to the negotiations, and I've had an actor actually re-record the source's end of the conversation, and then I actually modified the actor's voice so you get that nice little secret squirrel vibe. And it's also so you can't even tell who the actor is, because that's how goddamn staunch we are. In fact, I actually transcribed the other end of the interview and sent it to the actor, so the actor has never even heard our source's voice. So just so you know, if you tell us stuff, we'll be very careful about safeguarding your identity. Now, this interview goes for around 6 minutes, and you'll hear me ask some of the same questions that I went over with Graham. But this is just a slightly different perspective on things. So tell us, Secret Squirrel, how did this mess actually happen?
I don't think both parties saw eye to eye, and I think there's a number of levels where that happened. It became political, and I think it got a bit standoffish in some of the negotiations. Both sides have their own perspectives, and it's hard to always understand what actually happened.
Yeah, I mean, the way I hear it is two things. I mean, I just hear that there wasn't really a lot of good faith in the negotiations from word go. I mean, is that a fair comment?
Yes.
Why is that, do you think?
I think just differences in personalities. I think OSCERT didn't want to become the government CERT. They didn't want to have to contract specific services in a certain way. They wanted to continue doing what they'd done the way they'd always done it.
Mm. There's also a few funny numbers that I've heard, like that OSCERT were proposing for a time to more or less, get their consultants or their analysts or whatever. The only way they'd do stuff for the government was if the government would pay OSCERT $1,500 a day for them to do stuff. Have you also heard that?
I heard something similar, and I think, again, it wasn't a realistic figure they were putting forward. It was more just, we don't want to work with you at this point.
I also heard that they were planning to charge CERT Australia for subscriptions to data that they actually give to other CERTs for free. Is that correct?
Yeah, some of the data that they provide free to organisations, they were going to contract that back to the government.
Okay, and I imagine the government didn't probably view that too rosily.
Potentially not, but also you have to understand that really information is shared for free among the CERTs, and that's how it works. And there's a lot of valuable information that comes through that, and it comes through the fact that there are trusted relationships there. Now, if OSCERT are doing all this work and government wanted to purchase that, then maybe that's a different story, because they've had to tailor those feeds in a certain way for the government.
It sounded like, at least by the time the AusCert conference rolled around in May, that CERT Australia was already actively undermining AusCert. I heard from a couple of different sources that that CERT Australia was seeking to establish an office in Brisbane specifically for the purpose of poaching AusCert staff, which now looks like it's happening. I've had confirmation from the Attorney General's department. This is also what you've heard, isn't it? That as far back as sort of mid to late May, they were planning to sink the boot into AusCert.
The original plans were they were going to establish an office in Brisbane so they could better work with AusCert when they were contracting services to them. I think when that fell through, they decided to go ahead with those plans. Obviously, a lot of the staff they'll be acquiring will come from AusCert in Brisbane, so it makes sense.
One thing that I'm curious to get your perspective on is the idea of the CERT becoming a government function makes some people a little bit nervous, because quite often these sorts of incident data that people are handing over to a CERT, you know, it's pretty sensitive stuff, and it's not necessarily stuff you'd want to hand over to the Attorney General's department. Do you think that there's an inherent problem with a CERT operating as an extension of government?
I think that the CERT entities face this all over the world, with all the different respective jurisdictions that they work in. The CERTs really do need to make that clear that they're not scoring people, that they're not reporting this information up the line all the time. They're really just trying to respond and handle the incidents as best as possible. So there's definitely that trust relationship that gets built up between CERTs and their constituents around what will be shared and how that information will be handled and used.
But you would admit that there's a trust problem there, right?
But you look at an organisation like AusCert, I don't think any of the members have had issues in the past with information that has been shared. If trust goes, then it's gone. And I think that's why AusCert has been so successful, is because they've developed that trust over many years, nationally and internationally, and the trusted relationships that they have is really what's made them valuable. The hope is that the same sort of level of trust evolves with CERT Australia as well. I think by taking a number of AusCert staff, they'll be able to take some of that trust over as well initially.
Do you think AusCert can survive?
Yeah, I think it can, but how, I'm not quite sure. Obviously, the conference is a big entity in itself. A lot of income is generated from that and a lot of information shared through that. And there's a lot of good networking there. If a number of staff go off to CERT Australia, then it may be hard for them to maintain some of the services initially, but not all the staff are leaving. It's about six at this stage, only six.
What do you make of these reports that the government has effectively axed or closed AusCert? It seems a bit confused to me.
Yeah, well, that was going to be my next point. I mean, it really depends on what services CERT Australia is going to offer and what services AusCert is going to offer. And if they're duplicating the effort, then maybe, yeah, they've axed them because they're trying to take over. But if they're going to let AusCert run the feeds and the work they do, then, yeah, they can keep operating in that space.
I suppose one of the problems for CERT Australia too is it's taxpayer-funded. It's not a member-funded organisation, which means it's a little bit more exposed to political drama and, you know, funding cuts and things like that. Would you agree? Or?
I don't think we'll see the funding change, but certainly it will dictate how CERT Australia can carry its business and who it can have relationships with and at what level. AusCert were a lot more free in that regard. They didn't have that constraint. They were able to go out and do what they thought was the best job with the people they needed to work with.
Without being choked by red tape.
Yes.
Mm-mm.
And, you know, politically, two countries might not be seeing eye to eye over a certain issue or something like that. And you really don't want that coming down and impacting on operational issues and things.
That was our secret squirrel on the line from an undisclosed location there, deep in a bunker, secret squirrel bunker. Now, I should mention, too, that I conducted several interviews in preparing this report. The intro script to that report, you know, it might sound like it's just me shooting off at the mouth, but, I mean, that's as much information that I could pull together out of several interviews with people who wished to remain anonymous. Getting official information from either side has been very difficult. So, for all I know, there's some things that I've reported here that aren't entirely correct, but when you've got people being so obstructionist, it's very difficult to string together something that's entirely accurate. So I've done my best, and I hope that actually clarifies things for people. Anyway, it's time now for this week's sponsor interview with Checkpoint Australia's Engineering Services Manager, Aviv Abramovich. And by now, most people in the InfoSec industry have heard of the arrest of Specialist Bradley Manning. He was a US Army intelligence analyst who has been arrested on suspicion of leaking the so-called collateral murder video to WikiLeaks. The video showed a US helicopter mowing down a group of rather unthreatening-looking people milling around on a Baghdad street. Two of them actually turned out to be Reuters journalists. So way to go, US military. It also showed the helicopter firing on a van that came to do something as threatening as collect the wounded. Two young children inside the van were seriously wounded. It was both shocking, this footage, and sadly also par for the course in a sort of war situation, which is why, you know, war is bad. But I suppose the surprising part from an InfoSec point of view is it actually took an informer, convicted criminal hacker Adrian Lamo, to turn Manning in. Manning had boasted of his efforts to Lamo in IM conversations, and Lamo decided to turn him in, he says, because Manning's actions were endangering the national security of the USA. Now, my question is this: if the military knew which file had been leaked, why did it take an informer to turn Manning in? Why didn't the US military have sufficient logging on its networks and systems to allow them to identify the leaker? What the hell was going on? Checkpoint's Aviv Abramovich joins me now. And Aviv, it's incredible, isn't it, that they couldn't actually identify this guy?
Yeah, well, exactly. I think what I've seen, the more secure organizations are, then officially they have very strict policies on their I guess, sensitive information. But reality shows that it's all about education for the individuals that are actually accessing the information, managing it, storing it, making sure that they are aware of how to store it properly, how to manage it properly, and how to ensure that at least they have visibility on who's getting access to the information and who's taking it off and what are they doing with it.
I mean, does it surprise you that information this sensitive, I mean, that the logging wasn't sufficient for them to be able to identify who'd copied it off a top secret or off a secret network?
It is surprises me to some extent. It's very difficult to have a sensible audit system that logs every access through every possible means. So access can be over the network, can be over physical access, as in this case was. I believe he used a CD.
Read-writable CD with Lady Gaga written on it.
So it's very difficult to have a system that basically logs and audits all these different kind of access. So what you need is in addition to, I guess, a good technical system that prevents or monitors this sort of stuff, a good auditing system that at the end of the day collates all the logs from all the different access points and then produces a report on one what this person might have done or what file have been accessed and by whom.
Well, it would be nice, wouldn't it? I mean, if a specific file has leaked, to be able to, you know, pull up some magic console and say, okay, magic logging console, tell me everything that's happened to this file in the last year.
Exactly. I want a list of all individuals who had access to this file in the last year or month or whatever.
But we don't really have that yet.
It is available in different bits and pieces. The real challenge is coming up with an auditing system that actually collates the whole lot of the information.
Yeah. I mean, we're doing pretty well with event management in terms of like security events and things like that. But when it comes to more mundane logging like that, you know, who touched this file from where, what, you know, that's where it seems to fall down a little bit.
Yep. And there are data leakage prevention systems out there that will log individual file access, that will tell you, especially if this file is being copied out of a system, whether it's to burn into a CD or burned into or copied into a USB. A USB is much easier than a CD. You don't have to erase it. You don't have to have a CD burner. Most devices, they have USB ports anyway. So much easier to plug in a very small USB device and have that USB device hidden in your shoe or hidden somewhere else, so you don't even have to write Lady Gaga on top of it.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that I found very interesting about this is the room that he was accessing this material from. It was a physically protected room that had some sort of code that, you know, you were required to enter. And I presume that it's, you know, a different code for each person maybe. So they've got some sort of audit trail of who's come in and gone. And he said you just walked up and knocked on the door and someone would let you in. I mean, that's really what we're up against, isn't it? Is you can have all of the greatest profiles in the world,
but people have a habit of sidestepping them.
Absolutely. Data leakage prevention starts, and I think should start, in education of the individuals accessing the information. That's your first point, making everyone aware that there is sensitive information in a particular room that people need to be logged when they go in. They need to be signed off, not just by typing a keypad, but also someone identifying them in other means, ideally not a machine means, but a person in there looking at an ID, making sure that they've logged that person's name and role and letting them in. So that's the first step in educating people. And that's a real challenge also technologically. If you have 50,000 soldiers deployed and you need to educate all of them in how to ensure that data leakage isn't an incident, this is a real challenge also technically. How do you educate 50,000 soldiers, making sure that they're aware what to do with the information, how to behave with certain type of information?
Yeah, and then you've got the whole problem of willful disclosure, which is what it was in this case. It wasn't just a matter of someone accidentally leaking something. I mean, we were speaking before we started recording this interview, and, you know, the whole thing with DLP is, yes, you know, we all understand that it's mostly useful for preventing accidental disclosure, you know, people attaching the wrong things to emails and trying to send them outside of the organization. Very good for stopping that sort of stuff. But, you know, it's been said time and time again, DLP is not going to stop someone like this kid from being able to access certain material and then, you know, pass it on to WikiLeaks. It's just not going to do it. I don't know what you can do to stop someone with that sort of access from, you know, from doing the wrong thing, unless you've got a really effective audit trail and they know that that audit trail's there and they know that if they do this, they're going to get caught eventually.
Yep, absolutely. If someone wants willfully and wrongfully want to get information away, there are very, very few technological, if not effectively be impossible technologically to prevent him. The easiest thing that a person can do is memorize the information that they want to take away. Sometimes it's easy. It might be a document, so it's easy to then reconstruct the document out of memory. Sometimes it's going to be more difficult if it's actually a footage. But you can also copy it to your mobile phone. You can copy it to many other means. And it all boils down to education and control. If someone knows that someone else is monitoring, and there is an audit trail and there is a trail of evidence that can lead back to them, they are going to think twice and three times before they actually take the leap of faith and copy something that they shouldn't.
Well, I remember, you know, things certainly changed for certain government databases when all of a sudden, just, you know, if you're just dealing with a relational database, it's actually quite easy to do that sort of logging. Do you know what I mean? Find out who queried what, when, and keep historical records of those queries. The thing is, I mean, your logs can wind up being bigger than your database when you're doing that. But I think they introduced that in certain things, like where private investigators were bribing people who worked for organizations like, you know, the Roads and Traffic Authority or whatever, you know, to try to get updated addresses for people or whatever. These days, it's harder to do those sorts of searches because every time you access a bit of personal information on someone in most of these government databases, there is a record that you access that information. And as a result of that, I believe, I don't have any sort of evidence to support this, but anecdotally at least, I hear that that means that, you know, your privacy is less likely to be done by an insider. You always hear of these internal audits in various departments that turn up people, you know, people wind up being fired because it turns out they were looking up, you know, the medical records for a celebrity or something like that. And these audits do catch people.
Yes, they do catch, and most, I think, importantly, they do deter people from trying and doing something that either they're just curious of doing or they're actually thinking of, this is something I can make money off if I sell this information to a tabloid or something like that. But it might not be worth the risk if I can go to jail or
if I can get fired.
So, yes, it is education and a system that at least that the individual know that they're being monitored is a deterring factor. Mm. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. All right, Aviv, thank you very much for joining us this week on Risky Business, and I'm sure we'll chat to you again soon.
Thank you for inviting me, Patrick. It was my pleasure.
Checkpoint's Aviv Abramovich on the line there with this week's sponsor interview. And that is it for this week's show. I hope you've enjoyed it. And until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.